Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a new history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week I'm happy to say we have Eric Jensen on the show, and we'll be talking about his new book, Body by Weimar, Athletes, Gender, and German Modernity. Here's a very simple logic. Communities are made of people. People can either be sick or healthy. Communities, therefore, are sick or healthy depending on the sickness or health of their citizens. Now, this is a very compelling logic as well, because it seems to explain why nations or states succeed or fail. The ones that succeed have healthy citizens. The ones that fail do not. And of course, this suggests a program for political progress. Get healthy and stay that way, and your community will be healthy and stay that way. This idea can be found in many times and many places in world history. The Greeks knew it, the Romans knew it, and of course you find it everywhere in the modernizing programs of the late 19th and early 20th century. Well, in this fine book, Eric Jensen takes on the case of the Weimar Republic. The Germans, of course, had lost a war. They didn't understand why. And in searching for reasons, some of them arrived at the conclusion that it had something to do with the health of the German body. And so they set about improving it. And they did so by engaging in sports and in forming organizations that engaged in sports and in following sports and in all ways making sports seem progressive. People who had not played sports began to play sports. The rich and the poor, men and women, people of all stripes. And they were all playing, in a sense, as Eric points out, for Germany in an effort to make Germany great again. This is a terrific book, and I hope that it finds a wide audience. I enjoyed talking to Eric today, and I think that you'll enjoy the interview. So without further delay, here it is. Hi, Eric.
Hi, Marshall.
How are you today?
I am doing really well.
Good. I'm glad to hear it. Today we're talking to Eric Jensen about his new book, Body by Weimar, Athletes, Gender, and German Modernity. I was telling Eric in the pre-interview that although these Germans became, and this is really the story he tells, they became very athletic. I think by our standards, they were not very athletic, but we can come to that in a little while. There are some pictures in the book which will be entertaining for most readers because they demonstrate that athletics has come a long way, I think, since it was sort of pioneered by not only the Germans, but the Germans among others in the 1920s and 30s. But anyway, Eric, thank you for being on the show, and let me ask you to begin our discussion by providing us with a few words about yourself.
Well, I grew up outside of Minneapolis, Minnesota. When I was growing up, the sports I tended to be into were swimming. I later got into running and became really into that. I was also very much into tennis. And you'll know from the book that tennis and running both feature very prominently in mm-hmm. it. I was not a boxer, and boxing is the third sport in the book. I went to college in Harvard, graduated in 1989. I majored in history. After that, I went into the Peace Corps, and when I returned from the Peace Corps, I decided that I wanted to go to graduate school, and I went to the University of Wisconsin, and that's where I began doing my research on my dissertation, which ended up becoming this book. And I have been at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio since 2004, where I teach mostly modern European history, and I direct the honors program.
Oh, that's great. So tell us a little bit about how you chose German history and this particular topic within that larger field.
I was always interested in German history as a kid growing up, and I took German as my foreign language when I was in junior high and high school. For some reason, in my school district, they actually introduced us to German in the fourth grade. That was the first foreign language that all students learned. I think they thought that it was supposed to be very, very easy. I remember the workbook was called Ich und Du, and I sort of fell in love with it. A lot of students then left and got to junior high and went into Spanish or French, but I stuck with German, and I did a couple of exchanges in Germany and became good friends with some Germans. And when I got to college, I knew I wanted to major in history, and I knew that I wanted to concentrate within that subfield in German history. as to how I got onto the topic that ended up becoming my book, it actually goes back to when I was an undergraduate in 1988. This was the Winter Olympics were going on, and I was in a junior tutorial, and my junior tutor said, Eric, you've got to come up with a topic for your junior tutorial paper, which is going to be this 30-page paper. This is the biggest paper I'd written up to that point. And I was watching the Winter Olympics, and I was kind of wondering to myself, God, why are the East Germans cleaning up in kind of these obscure sports like luge and speed skating and biathlon, and didn't even know what the biathlon was. And I ended up exploring that, the role of sports and kind of socialist identity, national identity in East Germany. That kind of morphed into my senior honors thesis, which looked at a two-century trajectory of German sports history. And then in writing that thesis, I became especially interested in the Weimar Republic. And that is what I picked up when I got into graduate school, ended up writing my master's thesis specifically on the Weimar Republic, and then doing my PhD dissertation on that field as well, because I was just taken by the seemingly unlimited possibilities that emerged in the aftermath of the First World War. I mean, the Weimar Republic in many ways was so exuberant and so full of possibilities. And I was really drawn to that aspect of the Weimar Republic, that sort of initial optimistic, exuberant kind of cultural, social aspect of the Weimar Republic. So that's what I end up focusing on in my book.
Mm-hmm. Well, it certainly is a fascinating time and was a fascinating place. I think the more so because of what happened immediately afterwards, but we won't go there.
We can talk about it later.
Yeah, I want to ask some preliminary questions about sports in European culture generally and in German culture specifically. Did Germans play sports in the 19th century, late 19th century, prior to this? Did they play sports leading up into, I just actually read a biography of, well, actually it wasn't a biography of Hitler, but it was about Hitler's early years, and I don't think he played any sports.
No. it's interesting because Germany, beginning in the early part of the 19th century, in fact, at the time of the Napoleonic Wars, developed an indigenous tradition of physical culture that is sort of akin to gymnastics. In fact, it's a lot of gymnastics moves, a lot of group calisthenics. This was the Turnen movement that became increasingly popular, increasingly associated with nationalism, and at least initially in the 19th century, very much associated with political liberalism and kind of the movement for greater rights in the lead up to the revolutions of 1848. By the end of the 19th century, it's still very, very popular and has quite a following. Tended to develop a more kind of conservative outlook and tended to be a little bit more associated with conservative politics. At the end of the or in the second half of the 19th century, as British traders are increasing their activity with Germany, British engineers are coming in and working with German factory owners. Wealthy British men and women are visiting German spas. They begin to introduce British sports, competitive sports, into Germany, and that's when you see the advent of competitive track and field, soccer, tennis, and a number of these sports that we associate with more of the British physical culture tradition. Boxing was actually sort of quasi-illegal. It kind of varied from locality to locality, but it was definitely sort of an underground sport, at the very least a sport that existed in the shadows in the later years of Imperial Germany. And it's really not until 1918 that boxing emerges as this popular spectator sport. It was never a big participatory sport, but it emerges as a very, very popular spectator sport, 1918, 1919, 1920, and then it becomes, in some ways, along with the legendary six-day races, sort of the sport for kind of the social elite, and this is where you went to see and be seen in Weimar Berlin.
Mm-hmm,
But in terms of these competitive sports, they really come over from Britain, and they come over at the end of the 19th century. It's an important point to keep in mind because in this debate that emerges between Turnen and competitive sports in the 1920s, one of the big criticisms that Turnen has toward competitive sports is precisely that it's imported, that it's cosmopolitan, that it's foreign, and even worse, it's coming from, you know, the country that just defeated us in the First World War. Mm-hmm. It was tainted by all of these foreign connections.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So then the simplistic answer to the question is no. That they didn't. They really did not. They didn't. I said, yeah. I'm just trying to boil it down here because I do remember, and I don't remember a lot at my age, but I do remember the sport that I really associate with Germans in the late 19th and early 20th century is dueling, as in dueling scars.
Right. Yeah. Dueling. Dueling was big. Turnen was big. Weightlifting. There was a burgeoning weightlifting culture that the historian Ben Vedermeyer talks about in a number of his books. So there certainly were aspects of physical culture, but in terms of competitive sports, almost all of these were imported from Britain and kind of imported beginning in the 1870s and via these trading ports and kind of spa towns that attracted mm-hmm. British businessmen and British tourists.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very interesting. So the sport of kings, that's tennis, right? Isn't that the sport of kings? I don't think about it as the sport of kings.
Or warfare? I can't remember.
I don't know, but you know, I don't know, to someone like me who grew up in the Midwest, tennis courts were a dime a dozen. I mean, every time they built a park for kids, they built tennis courts too. So everybody kind of went and hacked around on the tennis court. But it was very different in late 19th century Germany. Tennis was a different sort of thing. Can you talk a little bit about that before it was popularized, which is, I guess popularized might not be quite the right word, but before it spread to other classes and genders?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I grew up in the Midwest as well, and absolutely every public park had a tennis court, and that's where I always went to play. And even today in Germany, kind of public tennis courts, the way we know them in many U.S. cities, are very, very rare. Huh. But they were even rarer in the 1920s. It was very much seen as kind of an elite, upper-class sport. You belong to a club. And it was, you know, it was not a sport for the unwashed. This was a sport for people who had connections. The interesting thing about tennis that begins to change over the course of the 1920s is it gradually becomes less aristocratic and more middle class. And this was particularly true for women. This was also true for men, but it was especially true for women, that in many ways, women saw tennis as an avenue of upward mobility, as kind of an entree into higher society, and for some of the most talented women, as a way to actually to make money. There were a small number of professional female players. And in fact, Suzanne Longland, the legendary French player, is really the tennis player who kind of pioneers the professionalization of tennis. But throughout the 1920s, it really was seen as this aristocratic upper-class sport, and this was particularly the case for men. And this only gradually begins to change by the very late 20s and early 1930s.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And what did people say about playing tennis? Did they say, well, you know, you really should be healthier than you are? Or did they say something as bald as, we were defeated by the Brits in World War I, so we need to get out there and do stuff, and we're going to play tennis?
Well, it was interesting. In terms of this post-World War I kind of redirection of attention to the body, in the sense that Germany was perhaps in a kind of a corporeal crisis as well as a political and an economic and a military crisis, all of that attention tends to get directed more toward what we're seeing at the time is very, very vigorous sports, particularly track and field, to some extent boxing as well. Tennis was always seen as a little bit more of a pastime and a game than as an actual sport. Tennis was never really seen as a way of invigorating the body. Huh. And again, this was especially true for men. For women, tennis was seen as a very vigorous sport. And in fact, there's this whole discourse that I look at in the book that emerges in the mid-1920s, where these commentators are looking at tennis and they're saying, why can't the men play like the women? Like, the women are out there actually transforming this into a sport, and the men are still playing it like it's a, you know, it's a game. It's like this leisurely afternoon of hitting the ball back and forth, where the highlight is really after the game, you sit down, you have coffee and cake. Like, to them, that was what the men's game was about, whereas the women had already successfully transformed it into a sport. And they're saying, you know, they're basically saying to the men, why why can't you play more like the women? Why can't you, you know, why can't you toughen up and like actually make this a sport? The interesting thing that I find is that a lot of the men were really kind of redefining, male gender roles, at the same time as well. And they were in a way, these sort of top, male tennis players are kind of role models for a liberated masculinity that is not so beholden to like sort of toughness and rigor and kind of sweat and strain, that is actually appreciating the pleasures of life, kind of a softer, more gentle, masculinity, a masculinity that makes space to be a dandy and to, you know, sort of enjoy the finer things in life. So it's really interesting because actually, at the same time as these commentators are saying to the men, why don't you toughen up? There are a number of men that are like, you know, we actually like it this way, and we're making this an art rather than a sport. And, you know, there's something about a beautiful, elegant game that is much more impressive and much more to be valued than a hard-fought, rigorous game. So there's a little bit of back and forth there with regard to the criticism of the men's game.
Uh-huh. Do you think that they resisted professionalization because they felt that games, if we can call them that, were just games, and that men, actually the only true sport for men was war?
Yeah, I think they resisted it for a number of reasons. Sort of one of the reasons they resisted it was that professionalization sort of turned this sort of, you know, elegant gentleman's pastime into something very crass and commercialized, that now this was going to become this sport where people are going to look at it as an opportunity to make money, and that in many ways it's going to take away the beauty and the elegance of the game. And it's also going to, you know, open up the game a little bit more to the unwashed, to the hoi polloi, that this is no longer going to be this elite refined game, because as long as they resisted professionalization, these tournaments were really mostly played by aristocrats or men and women of independent means that did not have to work for a living, because they were spending their winters in the Riviera, and they could afford to travel on their own dime to these various tournaments that were often held in spa towns. As it's becoming more and more commercialized, some of these players are seeing the potential for this world to disappear, as it in fact has. Mm-hmm. And so I think it was more from kind of a sense that commercialization was cheapening the game to some extent. And again, I think the resistance comes from both the men's side and the women's side, but I think much more from the men's side. I think a lot of certainly female tennis players themselves and commentators on women's tennis were seeing this as fantastic. This is yet another blow for women's liberation. Like, you know, these women are showing their legions of female fans how to be sort of independent people in a society in which, you know, it's increasingly common that they are not married and you know, can't count on men and mm-hmm. kind of have to make it on their own, and that these women are role models for how to do precisely that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I see. One of the things that I thought was fascinating about your book is it reminded me that Germans, a little bit like Americans, are nations of joiners, and they had clubs for everything, including things like tennis, and they had even magazines for tennis, many of them, if I recall correctly. Can you talk a little bit about the source base for?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, it's incredible when you look at the media landscape that emerged in Weimar Germany. I mean, I even when I teach classes on sort of 1920s German history, there are a number of very famous photographs of these absolutely jam-packed, crowded news kiosks where it's like, you know, they're like just hundreds of magazines of all stripes and varieties displayed. And they only show like a couple of those slides just to give mm-hmm. students a sense of just the incredibly rich media landscape. There were probably 40 general sort of sports magazines that were printed during the Weimar Republic. There were probably 80 to 90 sport-specific journals and magazines that appeared at the time. Every major daily newspaper had several sports pages. Some had in very, very thick sports sections. There were a number of newspapers, particularly the daily newspaper Bezeit Mittag, that was famous for kind of pioneering sports journalism, mm-hmm. and, like, you know, very, very famous for this. sports reportage. So it was a really, really rich landscape. And the great thing about doing German history as well is German journalists and German commentators, I mean, they're just very astute at self-analysis and at looking at what's going on in society, kind of examining kind of the larger ramifications of these changes in, you know, in what is essentially a leisure activity, sports. But they were really consistent about looking at what this said about kind of a larger commercialization of German culture, about what this said about German modernization, about what this said about changing gender roles for men and women, about what this said about changing bodies, what it meant to be a modern person in, you know, sort of this fast-paced modern society. So one of the things I absolutely love about it is just the incredibly rich base of news commentary that sort of analyzes sports through this sociological lens. And in addition to that, the other sources that I used for my book were a number of popular movies that thematized sports. I looked at cabaret songs. I looked at photographs, these commercial collectible photographs, especially of boxers, where they're basically marketing their bodies. I looked at a number of pulp novels. There were a whole series of kind of popular novels, dime store novels that took sports as their main showcase. Mm-hmm. So it's a really, really rich landscape. It was so much fun kind of sifting through all of this material and kind of looking at all this evidence, you know, transcripts of cabaret productions and memoirs of leading athletes and, you know, mm-hmm. the great commentators. There's this fantastic conservative commentator who went by the pseudonym Rumpelstiltskin.
Yeah.
And he wrote for the daily newspaper Tägliche Rundschau, which was owned by Alfred Hugenberg, a very, very conservative publisher. Rumpelstiltskin himself was a very, very conservative commentator. But he loved finding these sort of overlooked, kind of really interesting events going on in Berlin, and he's particularly drawn to female boxers and strong women. And so whenever there was something going on in Berlin, you know, I'd look at his column and he'd be there covering it. And he was just fascinated by these women. And he writes about them a lot, often disparagingly, sometimes humorously, but you could tell he was just riveted by the phenomenon of the strong, powerful, aggressive woman.
Mm-hmm. Well,
it's just absolute joy researching this stuff.
Yeah, I was going to say you mentioned female boxing, and so we can't let that go.
Actually, it's on the cover. We have to talk about.
Yeah, well, female boxing actually is kind of big now in Iowa for some reason. They have boxing matches in Iowa City quite a bit where I am, and I've never been to see one, but I imagine they're pretty fun. Now, as you say, boxing was a new thing to Germany. And I suspect that women didn't do it for a while, but then they did. Maybe you could talk about how boxing came to Germany. And a lot of your story revolves around one individual, that is Max Schmeling. And maybe you could talk a little bit about him too.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. The story of boxing is really, really interesting. As I mentioned, it was sort of this underground, quasi-illegal, depending on where you were in Germany, sport, prone to police raids. It was associated with low life. It was certainly associated with gambling. It was associated with carnival sideshows. Max Schmeling, who ends up becoming sort of this legendary German boxer, probably the greatest German boxer of all time and the world heavyweight champion in the early 1930s, he recalls as a child growing up and seeing boxing as this sort of carnival, crude, clownish pastime. Like, he only associated it with these kind of amusement park sideshows where it was clearly a scripted performance, and he was in some ways kind of turned off by it. Boxing kind of emerges out of the shadows 1918, 1919, 1920 in Germany, and really via the British. Again, it's one of these very clearly imported sports. the British had already introduced it as this kind of underground sport in the late 19th century, so it existed on a low level there. But the really big German boxers in the first part of the 1920s, interestingly enough, are these boxers who had actually been prisoners of war on the Isle of Man in this POW camp known as Nockalo. And in fact, in Germany, they refer to them as Nockalo boxers, and this was the Nockalo generation of boxers. And these early heavyweight champions, this guy Hans Breitensträter, he was one of the famous early champions in German boxing, he came from this POW camp. And so it's interesting. It's sort of introduced via these POWs, basically, who learn how to box. The British wanted to, you know, entertain the prisoners or keep them occupied, basically, while they were, you know, basically in this holding cell until the war ends. And so they taught them boxing. Boxing then becomes sort of the spectator sport, the social pastime in Germany, along with soccer and the six-day races. And these were these great urban sports in Berlin in particular. They would have these, organize these big boxing evenings where you'd have these, you know, just a whole series of fights that led up to the great heavyweight fight. And people would swarm from all over Berlin and from the outlying areas to these fights. And it became a real social scene. People went there to see and be seen, kind of the social elite, in particular the literary elite. I mean, there are a whole number of cultural luminaries who just, you know, loved boxing. Bertolt Brecht, probably most famously among them, but the theater director Erwin Piscator and Leopold Stokowski, the conductor, and just, you know, all of these people, George Grosz, these people would just come, and you really, it was kind of like a who's who in Weimar Germany at these big boxing events. Women's boxing also emerges at the same time. I think it's precisely because this space opened up where boxing was new to Germany, and it was sort of like in Germany itself was kind of in this anything go stage in 1919, 1920. And so it hadn't been like rigidly defined as an exclusively male sport quite yet. And women engage in a number of, as far as I can tell, competitive or at least semi-competitive boxing matches in the early 1920s. By 1922, 23, the boxing federations in Germany are getting concerned enough about this that they begin to crack down on women's boxing. And their concern really came from the fact that boxing in general was not taken as a serious sport, that it was seen as this commercial pastime, it was seen as just raw sensationalism. And the boxing federations were worried that, oh my God, these women boxing is just going to make it worse. It's just going to make it seem even more carnivalesque. If we want to be taken seriously as a sport, we need to define this as a male sport, and we need to really get serious about kind of cracking down on these more carnivalesque aspects. So this is what causes them to actually crack down on women's boxing and issue a certain number of bans. The interesting thing is boxing then kind of, for women, then morphs into kind of an exercise program. I mean, a little bit like boxercise today. Mm-hmm. There are a number of famous female celebrities who love to be photographed in front of the sand sack or the punching ball. And it becomes kind of very glamorous to engage in these boxing workouts. Vicki Baum, who's a great screenwriter, ends up writing Grand Hotel, emigrates to the United States. She boxed in the same gym that was turning out some of these German, these male German boxing champions, and writes very openly about, like, you know, look, I'm out there jumping ropes just like them. I'm in the ring, you know, sparring just like they are. And she even suggests at one point that, you know, if push came to shove, you know, I could defend myself. Uh-huh. So it's really interesting the way in which, despite the efforts on the part of the official boxing establishment to crack down and restrict and in their mind, hopefully remove women's boxing, that women's boxing continues to survive and in some ways even thrive, albeit more as a kind of an exercise and self-development program, kind of a self-actualizing program rather than as a competitive sport.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. When intellectuals trumpeted the virtues of boxing, what exactly did they say? I mean, these are people that some of whom, in living memory, they could remember when boxing was disreputable. And all of a sudden they're singing its praises. What did they say about it?
Well, the interesting thing about boxing, and I think the reason it became so popular in the 1920s, is that in some ways boxing spoke to this sort of larger impression that people had of modern society, that boxing in some ways was a reflection of modernity, that modern society itself, especially in Germany, where there's a fair amount of street fighting between various political groups, where there were a number of political assassinations early in the Weimar Republic, there was kind of this air of violence. One of the things about boxing that a lot of commentators at the time found so appealing was precisely that boxing was violent and therefore reflected society, but it was violence that was in a very controlled space. It was violence that was not threatening because it was demarcated by the ring, and there were very clearly two guys who were going at it, and the rest of the audience or the spectators could just watch. So a number of commentators talk about the appeal of boxing in Germany in the 1920s as being precisely because it was a reflection of the violence in larger society, but in a much more contained and safe environment. Mm-hmm. That's one of the reasons for its popularity. Another reason for its popularity that I read about in the book is that it kind of championed this individual, the individual hero, the individual fighter, the individual battler, in the same way that that World War I aces became very popular coming out of the war, precisely because the war itself had been this kind of mass slaughter where it was, there wasn't really room for heroism. It was just like all these people being mowed down seemingly. But the pilots were these individual figures. Oh, you could latch onto them as an individual figure. In the same way, the boxer was this individual fighter. He was a warrior you could kind of latch onto and say, ah, there's my hero, there's my individual in this sort of larger kind of faceless society. Mm-hmm. So that was another appeal, I think, of boxing. And the third appeal of boxing is boxing was very good at marketing itself. Boxing was the quintessential commercialized, sensationalized sport. They knew how to package an entertaining evening. They knew how to package personas and reputations around certain boxers. The boxers themselves were very astute at developing certain personalities and kind of a certain aura that they projected. And the boxers themselves were very good at marketing their bodies. You alluded at the very beginning when you interviewed me to how we might look at the bodies in the 1920s that were upheld as the ideal and kind of scoff at them a little bit because our standards have risen even higher. But for the 1920s, these were hot bodies and these guys knew it. And they knew how to market themselves. Yeah. And it's amazing that they're selling pictures of themselves. They're posing nude and semi-nude. Like, these pictures are being photographed in magazines. There was a whole series of novels about women who basically chase around these boxers and try to seduce them. They're just so into the boxers. Mm-hmm. So these boxers really—they saw them in a way. They were early sex symbols, and they knew how to capitalize on that. Mm-hmm. And there was something very appealing about that too. Yeah. For obvious reasons, sex sells for the public. And by the way, the women were doing the exact same thing. I mean, the interesting thing that the interesting point that I think I make about men's and women's boxing is it's like, they're both doing the exact same thing. They're both sensationalized. They're both marketing themselves. They're both incredibly commercialized. So, the differences between men's and women's boxing is like paper thin when it comes to the larger sociological meaning of the two sports. It's really amazing.
So the most famous boxer of the era, somebody we've already mentioned, and that was Schmeling. Can you tell us a little bit about him and how he was marketed? I mean, he did he became the most famous person in Germany. Am I wrong about that? I mean, was he?
Oh yeah, he was. I mean, he was one of the top celebrities. They did this one of the polls that I cite in the book. They did this poll of, I think it was 13 or 14 year olds living in Germany, asking them, first of all, who they recognized and who they admired, and Max Schmeling was the top vote getter, ahead of Karl May, who was every German male teenager and most German female teenagers know Karl May for his Wild West novels, mm-hmm. but even above Karl May, all these kids idolized Max Schmeling. He's this really interesting guy. He comes out of the Rhineland. He is really this self-made boxer. He kind of fights his way up from the working class, becomes incredibly wealthy. I mean, he is, in fact, he becomes almost as famous for his wealth as he is for his boxing prowess. There are a number of boxing journals that feature him in a business suit, kind of balanced on a rolling dollar coin. And the boxing reporters love to report on how much he was earning for each fight, especially when he did his tours of America. It was like, you know, they would comment on the fight later on, but first let's get to the important stuff, which is like how much he's raking in, in these fights. So, you know, I mean, all of the stuff that we talk about in boxing today and, you know, these, like, you know, these multi-million dollar fights, I mean, that, the precursors to that, you can already see it happening in the 1920s. He emerges as the top German boxer by, you know, 1929, 1930, 31, and then he wins the world heavyweight title, and he is the first German to win the world heavyweight title. This was seen as, you know, Germany's moment. We've arrived after the First World War. Interestingly enough, he wins the world heavyweight title on the same day that a German woman won the women's singles tennis title at Wimbledon. And, oh my God, the sports pages thought, like, oh, this is it. You know, we've finally proven that you know, we're back on top. Or, we're this great nation again. So he was absolutely this figure of adulation, and very, very astute. A businessman. He definitely knew how to manage his money and how to invest it wisely. He marries a famous film actress, Anni Andra, and they were sort of like the it couple for a long time in Germany. After the war, interestingly enough, he becomes a Coca-Cola bottler in Germany, which is so appropriate because it's so perfect because boxing was especially by the mid-1920s, was seen as kind of this vehicle for Americanization. There's this debate that emerges in Germany. What's the best style of boxing? Is it the British style of boxing where you win on points, or is it the American style of boxing where you win with a knockout? And Max Schmeling was definitely a proponent of the latter. He was about the knockout. And everybody associated him with America. He was the conduit to America. He did all these famous tours of America. He was earning a lot of his money in America. And so it's just perfect that after the war, he becomes this Coca-Cola bottler, introducing Coca-Cola into northern Germany. And he lived to be 100. He just died 4 or 5 years ago. Wow. Just incredibly long-lived man. Mm-hmm. So a very interesting figure. Mm-hmm.
What did he? This is a bit sort of a tangent. What did he do during the National Socialist time?
He was very, very popular. They organized a rematch between Schmeling and Joe Louis. Schmeling was not ready for this fight, and Joe Louis was just a far superior boxer by that point, and Joe Louis just basically knocks him out of the ring, and this was really promoted on the lead up to this. This was going to be, you know, of course, Joe Louis, the brown bomber. I mean, this, you know, this is going to be this black American versus this sort of, you know, Aryan German. And Joe Louis just pummels him. And so he returns to Germany in a little bit of disgrace. I mean, still well liked by many, many fans, but a little bit on the outs with the Nazis. He ends up being, I think, a paratrooper. He injures himself when he's paratrooping over Crete, and then spends most of the rest of the war. He recovers and then spends most of the rest of the war doing various stuff on the home front. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. There's been a lot of attention to him recently in biographies. There's been these questions about what he did during the Nazi period, and it turns out that, you know, he probably was involved in helping a couple of Jews escape, or at least get protection. Mm-hmm. But there's been a fair amount of attention over just how close he was to the Nazi leadership and what exactly he was involved in in Nazi Germany. But from what historians have revealed so far, you know, he acquitted himself, you know, relatively speaking, and quite honorably.
I see. So let's go on to the third sport you deal with, or set of sports, and that is track and field. Germans love to go at Wandern. I remember when I was in Germany, they always wanted to go to the Wald and Wander. And so lots of Touren. Yeah, that was – we did a lot of that. But running, when did that come to – when did that come to Germany?
Well, this was part of this wave of kind of British competitive sports that entered Germany at the end of the 19th century. So around the 1870s, what we think of as competitive track and field enters Germany. Becomes quite popular among a certain set of basically middle class people. If boxing was kind of this rough and tumble working class sport, and tennis was kind of this like elite upper crust aristocratic sport, track and field was really the quintessential kind of working class sport. This was the sport for the white collar worker, and it becomes very popular, especially in cities, very closely associated again with Britain. In fact, so much so that they were, even though Germany had been metric for quite a while, they were still measuring the distances in yards.
That's interesting.
And they were doing their high jumping in feet and inches. And they were doing some of the announcements in English. And you know, a lot of times it was English officials who were officiating at these German track and field events. So again, it kind of had this like kind of a taint of a foreign sport for a while. In the 1920s, it really becomes kind of the vehicle for kind of national regeneration to the extent that a competitive sport was really associated with this idea of keeping the population fit just in case we have to go to war again. Or, you know, in light of the fact that we don't have, you know, universal military service, let's keep the people fit. To the extent that discourse existed, and it absolutely did, it was kind of directed toward track and field because this was seen as the sport that would keep the body most fit, most, you know, ready to be mobilized in the event of a war. It's also interesting because track and field is a very, very strenuous sport. And women were getting involved in track and field from early on, certainly from the end of the 19th century and the early 20th century. By the 1920, they're getting, they're forming their own track and field associations, and they're organizing competitions and becoming very, 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 very active in track and field. This raises a whole new discourse in Weimar Germany, this anxiety over what effect track and field, especially strenuous running and strenuous like sort of jumping and throwing, what effect that has on these women's abilities to be future mothers. There's this huge concern about population in Germany, as there was throughout Europe after the First World War, and getting the birth rates up. This is a particular anxiety in France as well. It was acute in Germany, too, and there was this concern that women engaged in these strenuous sports, that they wouldn't produce healthy children, or they wouldn't be able to produce children at all, or, you know, or they just become so competitive and so focused on their sport that they wouldn't even want to marry and become mothers. I mean, you know, God forbid. So so there was this, all this hand-wringing about the larger kind of demographic ramifications of women's participation in track and field. The interesting thing is, over the course of the 1920s, and especially by the end of the 1920s, early 1930s, the discourse has really begun to shift. And in fact, there's a whole set of commentators and medical experts who begin to chime in and say, you know what? Not only is track and field not harmful to women and won't affect their ability to bear children, but in fact, it's actually good for women, and it'll allow these women to produce healthier children. And, you know, we as a country, don't we want them to be athletic and to be these mothers who will raise their children in kind of this athletic tradition? This was the discourse that was kind of emerging in the late 20s and early 30s. And so the interesting thing is this, you see this kind of amazing transformation taking place. By the early 1930s, one could make a good case for Germany being probably the most kind of women's sport friendly country, or the country that was probably most supportive of women's track and field. And that's a tradition, by the way, that I think you see reemerging with gusto in East Germany after the war. There are a number of reasons why East Germany turns to women's sports, not the least of which because they feel like they can rake in all these medals. But I think it's also a continuation of this Weimar tradition of celebrating women's sports. And even in the Nazi period, you know, for all the discourse of, you know, let's get women, you know, back into the homes, they acknowledged and kind of celebrated, you know, women's sports and the role of healthy women and healthy motherhood. So it's, there is this interesting continuity, especially in that regard, that extends, you know, through the 30s and 40s and into the, you know, 50s, 60s and 70s in East Germany.
I want to ask you a couple of broader questions, just to pull up a little bit. One of the things I do know about the era and sports is that in the Soviet Union at this time, the Soviet state went on a big kick to introduce athletics into schools, Physkultur, they called it. And this was, I guess, what we might call a kind of from above initiative. But it strikes me, having read your book, that almost all of it comes from below in Germany. Is that right?
For the most part, it does. I mean, there's certainly an official encouragement of sports and athleticism, and there are some officials, especially the mayor of Berlin, at the time in the 1920s was a huge proponent of sports. But at the same time, there were also people higher up in the national government who were either oblivious to sports or, you know, in some cases, somewhat hostile to sports. I mean, there's this famous quotation from Gustav Stresemann, who is, you know, probably the most famous political figure of the Weimar era and probably most famous as their foreign minister. But he had a couple of critical comments about what he saw as the biceps culture in Germany. And, yeah, exactly. And as you noted earlier, like some of the biceps of these people were sporting were not as impressive as they are nowadays. But there was, you know, there was a certain, in some circles, a certain skepticism as to the value of such a focus on sports. And among a certain number of intellectuals, the intellectual community was really split. There are some intellectuals, especially with regard to boxing, just absolutely loved it, embraced it. But there are also some intellectuals who really skeptical of sports, and they were really concerned because, you know, Germany was always, you know, the society and the culture of thinkers and poets, and had this great intellectual tradition, and they were worried that this intellectual tradition was being displaced by this tradition that was a little too focused on the body, and you see some of that being that discourse being repeated by certain national officials. But on the local level, just to emphasize again, there were a number of cities that had very, very activist mayors who were promoting this. So it's this kind of interesting. It's this interesting dichotomy.
Yeah. So to what extent did the people actually participating in the sports think of their participation as part of a movement for national renewal?
It's a good question. Probably not that much. There were certainly some leading athletes who definitely presented themselves as sort of these harbingers of what this national body should look like. But whether that was just self-marketing or whether that was a reflection of their true belief, I'm not sure. The best example of that I can think of is the middle distance runner Otto Pelzer, who achieves fame by beating Paavo Nurmi once, Paavo Nurmi, the great Finnish runner, and that cements Otto Pelzer's sort of legendary status. But he very much saw himself as this sort of patriot, this avatar of, like, sort of, you know, the national body, the fit body, really promoting fitness. He saw that as his mission. Most people, when they participated, they did it just for the sheer love of it. They did it because they liked the results that they got from it. They liked the bodies that they got. They did it as a form of socialization. A lot of people did it as a way to network with other people. I mean, this was a great way to meet people, and especially in a a very capitalist age, a very go-go age in the 1920s. This is a way to meet other people who were equally kind of driven and committed. A number of women did it, and they write about this. I mean, Vicky Baum is one of them, who write about their participation in sports as explicitly emancipatory. They mm-hmm. really see this as, you know, we're making a blow for independence or for a little bit of equality or, to be taken seriously in the public sphere. So mm-hmm. there are all sorts of motivations, and probably for most people participating, the actual sense that like, I'm contributing to the national rejuvenation was probably really low on the list.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But for some of them, it was there.
Yeah, no, I see what you mean. So let's ask about continuity or lack thereof. My impression is that when the National Socialists came to power, as you said, they said that women had a particular role in a German National Socialist state, and that was to bear children and support men.
Yes, but it's interesting because the effects and the importance of sports had been so thoroughly redefined by the late 20s and early 30s that by the time the National Socialists come to power, they really don't see that great a contradiction between women's participation in sports and women's roles as healthy mothers. And in fact, they see them as quite congruent. And so they kind of pick up where Weimar left off, and they said, you know what, like, this is actually good for women. You know, this will make women healthier, more exuberant, fresher. There was this sense of a kind of fresh-faced, wholesome athleticism that the Nazis really like to celebrate, as opposed to, sort of this heavily sort of make-upped woman who is overly dressed up and kind of an urban aesthete. That was the counter model of what they wanted mm-hmm. the woman to be. They wanted this woman to be like sort of vigorous and strong and kind of robust and wholesome and healthy. And so they really do kind of celebrate women's athleticism. Within limits, women's boxing is definitely on the outs. But women's track and field, absolutely fantastic. In fact, the women do very, very well for the Germans in the 36 Olympics. Leni Riefenstahl herself is like famously athletic and really helps to promote this ideal of athleticism for men and women. And so they really didn't see any contradiction between female athleticism and kind of a rejuvenated German motherhood or mm-hmm. emphasis on childbirth. In fact, they saw the two as going hand in glove.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other continuity that I think is important to keep in mind is that continuity that emerges after the war itself, and especially in East Germany, where I think there are a number of reasons why East Germans pick up on women's sports, but one of them is very much that there was this tradition of German women's sports that had already kind of solidified itself by the late 20s and early 30s, that carries through the Nazi period and that the East Germans really pick up. And, you know, when you look at the medals they're winning by the 1970s and 1980s, it's disproportionately in the women's sports. And one of the reasons was because, and there are all sorts of reasons, I mean, not the least of which, and I do not want to downplay the doping. It was absolutely
right.
Doping. But another reason for it is that they were one of the few countries that really took women's sports seriously and that said, here's an opportunity for us to win medals. Let's really emphasize this. And they were kind of pioneers in this, like, let's really seriously train our female athletes. And other countries then caught up as they were watching, you know, the East Germans basically eat their lunch.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's very interesting because I know that it's sometimes the case when I bring or am associated with people that come from overseas, particularly from Eastern Europe, and I bring them to the United States or been with them in the United States touring around, and I explain to them that we have this athletic culture and that young people of their own volition go and spend hundreds and thousands of hours practicing these sports. They kind of don't believe it. They kind of think, well, somebody must be forcing them to do that.
Yeah.
But it's not. I mean, they really want to do it. I mean, I know when I was growing up, I just played sports like crazy. And the only place I've ever seen that was really like that, where people as kind of a pastime would go and play sports, is Germany.
Yeah, Germany and I think there is this like Anglo tradition as well, like Britain and South Africa and Australia and New Zealand. But yeah, Germany, it's a very It's a very sport focused country, and they still have a just incredibly robust kind of sports media culture, and you know, sports pages, and you know, I mean, they produce even more famous sports champions now than they were doing in the 1920s. I mean, they're absolutely at the foreground of international sports. I remember right after German unification in 1990, I think it was like a Time magazine cover story, maybe it was Sports Illustrated. That might make more sense. But like, there was this big concern that like the Germany was just gonna wipe everybody else off the map, like in terms of sports. Like the next Olympics, it was just gonna be like Germany winning like five times more medals than the next person on the podium. That it was just gonna be it's just gonna be all Germany. But that didn't quite come to be. But they're absolutely one of the leading sports nations still.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you this, because I think a lot of people will be curious. We haven't talked about soccer at all, and I know that a lot of people associate Germany with soccer. They have a great tradition of it. Why is it not really focused on in the book?
Oh, it's a good question. When I started writing the book and researching the book, oh my gosh, I was not writing the book until much later. But when I started researching the book, I didn't really have a firm idea of which. In fact, I didn't even necessarily know that I wanted to narrow it down to particular sports. I thought, like, oh, you know, I'll get a sense of the discourse and kind of follow these leads and see where they take me in the archives. And so when I first arrived in Germany in 1997 to research this, really seriously, I followed a number of leads, and soccer was absolutely one of them. And I'm taking all these notes and kind of trying to figure out where this is going. And then, you know, I was emailing back and forth with my advisor and talking to some people in Germany. And finally I realized, okay, this is a huge, huge topic. And this could be like, you know, this could be like 70 books. I need to narrow it down. And, you know, it may be, because this is really a growing field in history, but I thought, okay, I've got to narrow this down. So I started thinking, like, okay, what sports might it make sense to include and leave out? And then I thought, like, okay, if I limit myself to kind of individual competitive sports that were imported from Britain, in which men and women participated, this gives me kind of a nice base where I can compare, these three sports. But you know, I want something different about them as well. And that's where, like, the class component comes in. I thought, like, okay, if I have, like, kind of one upper-class sport, one middle-class sport, one kind of working-class sport, this would be nice. But in terms of the elimination of soccer, it really happened when I thought, like, okay, I really want to focus on individual sports, especially because one of my larger arguments is that these athletes become models for how to be modern in a modern society. Mm-hmm. And I really wanted to look at sports that kind of emphasize kind of timekeeping, speed, efficiency, you know, getting to the shot in time, you know, crossing the tape, you know, in a record time, like, you know, being able to go the distance and round after round in a boxing match. I wanted to look at sports that kind of distilled what I saw as a modern sensibility in an individual sport, because I think individualism is also very much a part of being modern and the modern body. So for those reasons, I ended up kind of reluctantly leaving soccer out of it. The other reason is a lot of people have written about soccer. Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I did not know that. I just, it's something that I associate from my own childhood. We played soccer in addition to football, and football, that's confusion. But I just wondered kind of where it was. But that's a judicious choice, I think. I mean, whenever you approach a topic like this, you think you're going to write the history of sports in X, but it turns out that – or history of anything in X. But it turns out, as you say, there could be 70 books about that.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
I like that phrase very much. I may steal it and use it without attribution to you.
You should. You know, and you already have competition. I just heard from someone a couple of days ago who's, like, writing a big book on women's soccer kind of over the course of the 20th century. It's, you know, I think in the aftermath of particularly the World Cup, where I think this was the World Cup where, like, Americans were like, oh my gosh, soccer's this really cool sport, or it's like, you know, we're starting to watch it more. I think there's going to be this real uptick in kind of sports history scholarship, and especially histories of soccer.
Yeah. Well, I hope so. And if your book is any measure of the quality of thing that we're going to see, then I think we have looked forward to some really good stuff.
And, thank you very much.
We've been talking to Eric Jensen today about his book, Body by Weimar, Athletes, Gender, and German Modernity. Eric, I want to say thank you very much for being on the show. But before I let you go, I want to ask our traditional final question, and that is, what are you working on now? One of those 70 books, I take it.
Exactly. Number 68. Yeah. Or 69, whatever we're at. It's building off of a really interesting figure that features prominently in chapter one of Body by Weimar, and it's this woman, Paula von Resnicek, and she is this absolutely fascinating chameleon-like figure who is able to reinvent herself at a number of different stages in her life and in her career. She's a pioneering female journalist in the 1920s, as well as one of Germany's leading tennis players, as well as a real strong proponent for sexual emancipation, mm-hmm. the sexual liberation of women, that women should be able to have sexual partners as often as they wanted without strings attached. She's also a very strong proponent of women being in the workforce. She ends up, because of her Jewish background, going sort of underground in the Nazi period, but not underground in the traditional way. Underground, she married Hans Stuck, who was this legendary German auto racer. By virtue of her marriage to him, she's accorded a certain amount of protection. Mm. And she goes underground in the sense that she no longer plays a public role herself, but she invests all of her energy and all of her considerable journalistic talents into kind of marketing her husband. Mm-hmm. And in fact, Germans at the time referred to it as the Stuck Enterprise. And it was really Paula von Resnicek behind the scenes mm-hmm. kind of operating things and kind of shaping his public persona. And after the war, they get divorced and she reinvents herself again. So I wanted to do this kind of biography, kind of deep, rich biography that kind of looks at the life and times of this woman through the prism of her own life and her own actions. I think it'll be a lot of fun. I think it'll be a lot of fun to work on. And she's absolutely fascinating figure. There really is not that much on her. Her Wikipedia page is one sentence long. Last time I checked, she deserves more than that.
Yeah, and I think so too.
Much
yeah.
more than that.
No, that's exactly right. Well, it does sound like a fascinating topic. I'd never heard of her before I read your book, and I look forward to reading more about her. But for now, let me say thanks for being on the show, Eric, and I'll talk to you later, okay?
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an interview with Eric Jensen about his new book, Body by Weimar, Athletes, Gender, and German Modernity. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I hope you have a great week.